Section 24-4-103. It is Monday, June the 12th of 2006, and it's about 10 minutes after 9 a.m. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room at 1700 Broadway, Suite 270 in Denver, Colorado. I am Secretary of State Gigi Dennis. I'm convening this hearing in accordance with a rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on May the 10th of 2006. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's elections rules. The Secretary of State's office prepared a draft of the proposed amendments to the rules that was distributed to the public and published on the office website. A copy of the draft is available on the table in the back of the room if you had not yet received one. As stated in the notice of rulemaking, the purpose of the proposed amendments is to clarify and conform to statutory changes made by the Colorado General Assembly and to make such other amendments to the election rules as may be desired to improve the administration of elections in Colorado. I'd like to introduce all of the folks here at the table. To my left is Deputy Secretary of State Bill Hobbs, Monica Marquez, who is Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, John Gardner, IT Specialist. What's your official title, John?
Voting Systems.
Thank you, Voting Systems. To my right, Holly Lauder, Elections Director, Christy Hubbard, who is has handled all of the rulemaking and preparations for today's meeting. Christy, I don't know your official title either. What do we call you?
Rules Coordinator.
Rules Coordinator.
In this capacity.
And Hillary Rudy, who is working temporarily with the Secretary of State's office. So welcome to all of you, and thank you for joining me this morning. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. This meeting is being audio recorded, and all comments become a part of the official record. For anyone who wishes to testify at this hearing, there is a sign-up sheet. We do have a few that have signed up already, so thank you. For the record, my office has received many written comments for the proposed rules. All comments have been received, will become part of the official record for this hearing. This time, all interested parties have an opportunity to submit any data, views, or arguments on amendments to the elections rules in writing and, if desired, today orally. This hearing is scheduled to conclude at noon. In the interest of time, I would request that you avoid simply repeating the testimony of others and offer other suggestions. When you speak, we'll ask you to please come up to the podium. You are being recorded. And so if you would identify yourself and or any organization that you may be representing. All right, we're ready to get started. Carol Peoples, would you please join us? Welcome, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Carol Peoples. I am the founder of Colorado Voting Project, grassroots effort to educate the formerly incarcerated in Colorado about their voting rights. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to talk with you. First, I wish to thank the clerks for following through on my request at last year's rulemaking hearing regarding notification of canceled voters due to incarceration. I understand that any voter whose registration is canceled due to the DOC database match is now notified in writing of his or her cancellation. I also wish to thank the staff of the Secretary of State's office and the Denver Election Commission for their cooperation and efforts to work toward greater awareness of the voting rights of all eligible voters.
And Carol, I'm sorry, with the noise of the air, yeah, the microphone pulls forward just a little bit.
Okay. I hope we can continue to work on our educational efforts, especially with regard to specific questions and answers on the website, on each organization's website, and developing a protocol for jail-based voter registration and voting for eligible citizens. And that's what I'm here today to talk to you about. I understand today's rulemaking hearing concerns revisions and amendments to election rules, specifically from this last year, but I speak to rules that were made in the previous year and then also just the existing statute as it is, that a protocol remains to be established. And so I wish to use this opportunity to advance a number of questions to specifically address absentee ballots, provisional ballots, and identification information. Colorado Revised Statute 121034 allows for incarcerated misdemeanants and pretrial detainees to register to vote and to vote. So my questions are to jumpstart the process of establishing a jail-based voter registration protocol, and they are by no means exhaustive. First, how will incarcerated individuals obtain voter registration forms when they don't have access to computers? Two, if they've been incarcerated longer than 30 days, what is their county of residence for voting? Three, once registered or if previously registered, will these individuals use absentee ballots or provisional ballots? Can inmates use pencil to fill out registration forms and ballots? Black pens usually are not available inside. How will the ballots be collected? Can you deputize someone to go and collect them, or will they be sent through the mail? Many jails' mail systems, as I understand it, are quite lengthy in their turnaround time. By the delay of time, all these votes could eventually just not be counted just because of the way the jail systems work. What direction will the Secretary of State's office give the sheriffs and county jails, and what kind of educational outreach can there be for jail staff? What type of educational outreach will there be for sentenced misdemeanants and pretrial detainees? And how will jail staff be held accountable for the administration of this civic right? And then my next question regards identification information. First-time voters can register to vote through the mail without any identification. So this is the scenario. Someone's incarcerated, they register to vote while they're in the Denver County Jail. However, then the voter must supply a photocopy of acceptable identification with the ballot. So let's say we have a means of that person to receive an absentee ballot or provisional ballot, whatever you decide. But they don't have access to their documents. The documents are kept in personal property, in a separate place. So what kind of protocol can the Secretary of State's office initiate with the jails throughout Colorado to work with their needs, but also the civic rights of these individuals? And I did a little research into the number of people who are affected by this, and the figures are hard. They're not that easy to find, but last year, the Sheriff's Association did a point-in-time study, and there were 12,500 people in Colorado's jails. And they don't have county-by-county statistics for pretrial detainees and sentenced misdemeanants. However, in 2004, the Denver County Jail released some statistics, and at that point, a total of 87% of the jail population in Denver was eligible to vote because they were either pretrial detainees or they were sentenced misdemeanants. I hope the Secretary of State's office will work with jail staff to develop a protocol for jail-based voter registration and voting. This will take effort, as each organization brings many requirements and restrictions to the table. I also hope jail staff will be part of the educational outreach, for many of them may be unfamiliar with the voting eligibility of the people they oversee. Eligible voters in jail are at great risk for being inadvertently disenfranchised by nature of their incarceration. But here's what it breaks down to. A pretrial detainee who can afford to post bail can vote. A pretrial detainee who can't afford to post bail can't vote. We ignore that. And should we ignore the fact that it's by law, misdemeanants can vote? And if we think it's too difficult to devise a process to give them access to the ballot, what are we saying about their vote? Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. I realize that you have a lot on your plate, and this is one more thing, but I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol. Are there questions, committee? Bill?
Could I ask, maybe two questions, I guess. Is there anything that you're aware of, first of all, that's been drafted that might be of guidance to us, and second, is this a subject that might be better handled through legislation rather than rulemaking? What are the pros and cons of rules versus legislation in this area?
First, the only thing that I know that's been drafted is the ACLU put out a jail-based voter registration booklet that has a lot of questions, and I have left a copy with a staff member of Secretary of State's office. And using that, I've developed a draft of a protocol, which I put out to a couple people just to see. I've developed a couple connections in the sheriff's offices just to see, will this work? Trying to get an idea of what it's like for them from inside the jails. And it is difficult. It's a lot of paperwork. And as for your second question, but I think that it's doable. I think if we can just hammer out some questions. But I'm not going to get, they're not going to answer me. It's going to take the Secretary of State's office to push them to come to the table with this. As for your second question, I don't know. What do you think?
Don't have an opinion at this point. Just wondering.
I really don't know.
Without knowing, you know, I guess, without having, it sounds like it would be kind of complicated, and I don't know whether it's controversial, you know, but I guess if I saw something in writing, that's why these are two related questions, if I saw something in writing, it might be better to know whether it's more of the character of legislation versus rules, which tend to be more interpretive or filling in the gaps and that kind of thing, or procedural.
If it's on the statute, and it's clearly stated in the statute that they can vote, doesn't that then call for the rule-making process to occur?
I mean, that may be one argument in favor of rulemaking, but I don't know. I just was curious what you thought. So.
Okay. At this point, I mean, judging by in 2004, the election in 2004, it seems like an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We can do a lot to take care of this, because I would assume there are going to be get-out-the-vote efforts to do jail-based voter registration. And if there's a protocol in place, then it's so much easier. You just give this to the sheriffs. You give this to the groups. And people know, and that way you don't have Channel 9 out there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Carol. Thank you for coming down today. Good. And, Chris, do you receive the information she was talking about?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. Aunt Rita, would you come here for a moment, please? I'd like to next call Gail Miller. Oh, I'm sorry, Rita.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. No. Would you go get me another pencil? I'm out of lead. Mr. Miller?
I apologize. The noise is a little loud from that machine. My name is Gail Miller. I am the co-chair of the Colorado Lawyers Committee Election Task Force, which is a group comprised of a number of, it's kind of an umbrella group of a number of legal groups, including the representatives of both political parties, Common Cause, and each of the minority bar associations. And we have been, for the last couple of years, following the recent developments in election law, including the very hard work that all of you have been putting into this process. I have submitted a statement on behalf of the task force, and I only wanted to comment on a couple of the points there. I think the other issues are self-explanatory. And I should add, some of the member groups of our, or some of the participating groups in our organization may be submitting separate comments. First comment I want to point out, deal with, is the sections 44.2.3 and 44.4.1 dealing with voter registration drives, and specifically the voter registration form. We appreciate that the draft has been revised to not make the state form the exclusive use, but we believe that it probably makes sense for the rules to make reference to the federally approved form, the form that was put out by the U.S. Election Assistance Commission under the National Voter Registration Act, just so county clerks are aware that that form is a permissible form. So we would urge that be included in the rule and perhaps in the instruction that's provided to county clerks as well. Second, on identification, we would request that the rules, specifically 2.7 and 30.1.6, include a specific reference to documents, any document issued by the clerk and recorder of the county in which the voter seeks to register to vote that gives the voter's name and address. We believe that fits within the definition of government document, and we thought it would just make clear that if there is something coming from the county clerk's office indicating the voter is registered and with the date, not that the voter is registered, but that it has the voter's address and name, that would meet the requirement of government document. It would be subject to the current requirement that it would have to be done within 60 days before the time that it's presented. So we would urge that that be included also. Other than that, those are our comments, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Questions, committee? Monica?
Gail, can you give us an idea of what sort of examples of these documents that the county clerk might have that would contain the name and address?
Could be a letter from the county clerk saying that so-and-so is registered, that they could present at the polls. It could be a card that comes from the county clerk to the voter saying, here's your precinct, here's where you vote, which would state to the extent it states the address and name of the voter, which it typically does. Those are the kinds of things we're thinking of.
Thank you.
It definitely could be a letter just for that specific purpose issued by the clerk and recorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Holly?
Excuse me, are you also including like the voter information card that's sent out prior to an election?
Yes, I think that would be complete.
And also the notice that the elector receives after they've registered to vote?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Appreciate your comments, and thank you for writing something up as well. Jenny Flanagan? Morning, Jenny.
Morning, everyone. My name is Jenny Flanagan. I'm the Associate Director of Colorado Common Cause. We are members of this task force and support the comments that were submitted. We just have a couple of additional comments that I wanted to point out and answer any questions you may have regarding it. The first one regards Rule 30.5.4 and how a voter registration or a get a little confused with the use of the word elector and voter throughout the rules, so forgive me if I'm not using the proper term. It's our recommendation that in the case of a voter who doesn't meet those new requirements of all of the different IDs, that they receive a tag status, as is given to many voters who have incomplete voter registration forms throughout the rule. We feel that the tag status is a preferred method that will give the voter greater protection on election day and as they move through the process and enable them their right to vote. Currently, the rules have been changed since the April 24th draft to say that that voter would not be registered at all. It's my understanding that the tag status is also a pending status, so that tag would still require the voter to meet the requirements of identification. But because they would be in the database and they would be on the records, they would be afforded greater protection at the polling place. I will also point to Rule 30.6, which provides that an elector who does not have those, again, the same list of identification, and the clerk is able to, as they're processing the form, locate a number or identification that would meet that requirement, that they would be allowed to enter that information and, again, give that voter a tag status. So it was our recommendation that at a minimum the rules be changed to say as except as provided in Rule 30.6, you know, the elector, you know, if they don't meet the requirements of 30.5. But again, it's our preferred recommendation that that voter gets a tag status rather than a non-registered status. A point I wanted to bring up that's not in my comments is just sort of the process of how a voter would be notified if there were any problems in their registration form. It is noted in the statutes, but I don't see it in the rules what the procedures are for the clerks to notify voters if there's any problem with their registration. I understand that they are notified. Some of the questions I have are, what kind of notice are they receiving? Do they get very specific? You didn't provide your driver's license, or your driver's license was incomplete, so that a voter has the opportunity to remedy and knows exactly what the clerk is looking for so that they can complete their registration. Going back to the rules I submitted, 1B, I note Rule 30.12.2 regarding the election judge's instructions on doing a match of ID at the polling place, and it specifies to ensure a match of the name and address. In Rule 30.4.1, talking about verification of information, there's a little more leniency in terms of names that are given, like nicknames or other variants of the name, and it would be our recommendation that that also be included in instructions to election judges so that they are enabled or allowed to, you know, use of nicknames or other kind of variants of a name when a voter presents ID at the polling place. The final comment we submitted today addresses the voting systems and anonymity and the confidentiality of the votes. We think this is a great step forward. We understand this is, you know, the most critical aspect of voting, that a voter feels that their vote is protected and remains confidential. We think there may be more work to do on it. I think this is a great first step. I don't pretend to be an expert on how to protect the confidentiality of the votes, but I am sure that there are people out there who are thinking about this. And while I think the list is a good beginning, I'm not sure that it's an exhaustive list. So I would encourage the Secretary of State and the clerks and really reaching out to other experts to continue the dialogue and thinking through ways to make sure that votes are kept confidential and security measures are in place. Thank you very much.
Jenny, on your tag status, is that similar to what we have been referring to as the unique identifier? Or I'm not sure exactly why someone would go in ahead of time.
Currently, as I understand it, throughout the rules, there are situations when a voter will receive a tag status. For example, a voter who registers by mail but doesn't submit a copy of their identification. They would be registered, but they would receive a tagged status in the registration rolls. That voter can remedy either before Election Day by bringing in that proper identification, or on Election Day when they bring identification, then that tag can be removed. So it's sort of a term of art used throughout the rules of a status. The unique identifier is, in the case of a voter who registers in person and doesn't have an ID doesn't have the license, doesn't have the state-issued ID, and doesn't have the Social Security number. In those cases, the unique identifier would be assigned. So the tag status is a separate.
Well, the tag status also applies to people that are registered by mail that vote absentee and have to include their identification with their ballot when they return it.
That's right. There are a lot of examples of why a voter might like get a tag status.
Okay. All right. Further questions? Monica?
How do we square your proposed change with Senate Bill 170? Because it's my understanding that now requires the voter to provide the number, one of the three numbers, which is a separate issue from providing some sort of copy of identification. We're talking about the three numbers. And it's my understanding that Senate Bill 170 now says, if you don't provide one of the three numbers, you shall not be registered.
I think the interpretation of a tagged status, and correct me if I'm wrong, that person is really not fully registered in the sense that they would not receive a regular ballot on Election Day if they have a tagged status, unless they are able to produce an identification that removes the tag. So we would argue that same rule can apply in this situation. A tagged status is not a fully registered voter, but being in the database and being in the system with that tag is a greater protection of a voter who has attempted to register than simply not registering them at all.
So, in essence, you would be proposing sort of a separate style of tagging, in other words, something different from the ID tag. This would be sort of the failure to provide the number tag. Do you understand the distinction?
I do understand the distinction. I don't know that it needs to be a separate, but I would defer to.
I'm just trying to figure out what our protocol would be if we were to incorporate that here. But it sounds like it would
You're
have to be something.
I mean,
I think what you're suggesting is a separate protocol for the failure to provide one of the three essential numbers. Is that correct?
Jenny?
Yes, essentially. We think it could be applied in either way. I mean, obviously, if it needs to be a separate procedure, because one of these three numbers needs to be submitted in order to first go through the process of registration. You're maybe giving an example of somebody doesn't provide a number, but they provide a form of ID otherwise.
So yes.
I see what you're saying. I think that there are, yes. My answer is we would like to see that tag and get that person into the system rather than not in the system at all, whatever the procedure may be.
Thank you.
Further questions? Great. Thank you, Jenny. Mr. James? I'm sorry, is it Davey?
Dante.
Dante, excuse me, thank you.
All right. Well, I'm not a doctor, I guess. Good morning.
Good morning.
Name is Dante James. I'm the project director for AAVIP, which is the African American Voter Information Project. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that focuses on voter education, information, voter registration, and have collaborated with, I think, most of the people in the room on various issues at various times. And just as a preface, we would support each of the comments made by the previous speakers regarding incarceration and voting and the use of the federal form and relation commentary related to the form. What I'd like to speak on very briefly is Rule 11548 regarding discrepancies, regarding audit and discrepancies that may arise in any audit. I was on the canvas board at the most recent election in Denver County. The significant piece that I think is missing is that the audit report required does not require that the report address any anomalies regarding either the count or the machines themselves. Denver was using optical scanners. It's my understanding that there is an acceptable number of errors allowed per machine, and therefore the requirement was or is to make the numbers balanced, no matter how many times a manual recount must be necessary to figure out where or what anomaly may exist. The example in Denver that caused me some question was the machines were misreading the ballots because of how they had been folded. And subsequent to probably five or six separate manual recounts, it was figured out that the machine was in fact doing this. There was no ability to determine whether the count had been, whether the actual ballot had been counted correctly. The only requirement was that the numbers balance. And once the numbers were balanced within the acceptable margin of error, all the report had to say was, our numbers are fine. And we have reached a conclusion, and here it is. But the report does not require that Secretary of State be notified that there may be an issue with the machines. There was nothing that had to say the machines have difficulty reading ballots that are folded a certain way. So my suggestion or recommendation would be that the report to the Secretary of State on the audit require that any discrepancies or anomalies within the ability to find a balance in the numbers be reported so that there can be a trail of machines that may have a certain issue, a trail of issues such as the fold, which I know was a problem not only in Denver, but that the counties have to report, yes, that the numbers have matched, but yes, also that there was a difficulty in doing that because of this particular issue. So that's the only commentary, I think, on this, is that as opposed to just allowing the counties to say all is well and the numbers are fine, But that, in fact, we had some difficulty. It took us six times to make the numbers work. And the reason for that was because of this issue with this machine or something like that. So, thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. James. Holly?
Mr. James,
yes, ma'am.
Pardon me. Do you know if the absentee ballots, and I'm assuming that that's what you're referring to, were the absentees that were folded prior to being counted?
Correct.
Do you know if Denver County had those absentee ballots pre-scored before they were mailed out, or did the office itself fold the ballots to mail them out?
I believe they came that way.
It came pre-scored?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a question.
We're not going to let you off that easy.
Mr. James, did I understand right? You were a Canvas board member during... Okay, thank you for filling that capacity. I appreciate that. Do you know what the acceptable margin of errors was?
I do not.
That Denver was
within what I was told was the acceptable margin of error, which was a new term of art for me concerning ballots and voting. So I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dante, for coming down today. Met Toya over the weekend, and
she left me a message. So
very nice. Okay.
More signing up, or is that?
Yes. Is it
someone signing up to testify, or?
We know that face.
And now she's not playing. So.
Okay. Anyone? The lady behind, and right there, shaking. Okay, terrific. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, is there anyone else that would like to add any additional comments or concerns? Testify? Okay. This time, we will take all of your comments under advisement. Like I mentioned earlier, we had received some emails and letters from people that we are also reviewing. Taking all of those into consideration. Let's see, the record will be open through the business day of tomorrow, June the 13th of 2006, to allow any other additional comments or concerns or suggestions that you all may think about in case you have a sleepless night with all the heat tonight. So that concludes this portion of today's hearing. It is 9:40 a.m. Thank you for all those participating. We're adjourned.